This is transactional entertainment lawyer Joshua Lasteen, and you're listening to the Geekcast Radio Network.
And welcome to another Geekcast Radio Presents interview. I'm your host, Steve Megatron, with TFG1 Mike.
Hello.
Today, we're going to be talking with Joshua Lasteen, who is a leading entertainment lawyer with expertise in deal-making, intellectual property, and creator rights. His experience at top agencies and studios give him unique insights into Hollywood trends and the business of creativity. He's a passionate advocate for independent creators and a knowledgeable voice on geek culture and fandom. Hi, Joshua. How are you?
Hey, Steve Megatron. Hey, Mike. Hey, Geekcast. So thrilled to be here. I'm doing well this evening. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Yeah, this was kind of cool to get the invite to talk with you.
Yeah, no, I was really excited to do this. You know, usually I get stuck on stuffy, boring lawyer podcasts, but every now and then I get to do one of these really fun, cool podcasts with you guys and talk about lawyer things, but still kind of more in the geeky realm. So excited to be here.
Awesome, awesome. So usually how we begin these is we kind of do like the intro about you. So can you tell us a little bit about your journey to becoming an entertainment lawyer, or was there like a particular experience or case that kind of sparked your interest in this field and then kind of in tandem with geekdom?
Yeah. You know, let me start by kind of explaining what an entertainment lawyer is, or I guess what type of entertainment lawyer I am anyway. I'm what is known as a transactional entertainment lawyer. I'm not a litigator. I don't go to court. I don't wear a suit and tie and argue in front of a judge. So all of the stuff you see on Law and Order or on Suits or any of those cool shows, that's completely not me. I strictly handle contract deal making, negotiating actor, writer, director, voiceover deals, and things related to film and television. So that really is my, you know, 24/7, 9-to-5, 365, whatever you want to call it. I live, breathe, and eat the entertainment world. And like you said, specifically, my clients lean more into the animation space, horror genre, indie filmmakers, user-generated content creators, and those interested in nerd culture, because that's really, you know, what I consume as a consumer myself. So circling back to your question about my journey and how I kind of got here, it is so intertwined with geek culture in pop culture in general, I guess I should say. You know, really what spurred me in even just knowing what an entertainment lawyer was back when I was a kid, you know, the original Star Wars, not the original Star Wars VHS, but the new edition re-releases in the 1990s and those awesome gold box cases. You know, they had an extensive amount of behind the scenes, extended cuts, interviews with George Lucas and Fox executives, in particular, Alan Ladd Jr., who was the head at Fox at the time. And so I was always kind of aware that there was this business side of entertainment. I was aware that, like, you know, Hollywood was a money-making, deal-making machine. And I always knew that that was where I wanted to work, where I wanted to play. I was very passionate about also going to law school and business school at kind of the same time. I majored in business economics when I was in undergraduate, and it was kind of at the early height of the original MCU, the original Iron Man, the original Captain America, the first Avengers and stuff. And it was just, I just had so much fun growing up as a kid tracking things like box office metrics, how much stars are getting paid on what, and you know, not necessarily in the tabloid nitty gritty, but like on the business side of entertainment affairs. So yeah, fast forward to a young law student, I actually, in 2012, 2013, got to intern for Marvel Studios, got to work on a bunch of their projects that were in production at the time. Avengers Assemble, Ant-Man, the original one, the original Guardians of the Galaxy, Avengers 2, got to work on a little bit, as well as do really cool things like license Iron Man's image to like Pennzoil bottles and like REI for sleeping bags and fishing boxes and things like that. So, you know, it really is kind of amazing when you get behind the scenes of things and just see how much frickin' paperwork is involved in everything. You know, you would be amazed at all the different type of deals that someone like me has to handle, whether those are, you know, actor agreements, writer agreements, location agreements, merchandising agreements, you know, a wide variety of different things. So you know, I've had a pretty awesome career in getting to work on projects that I, you know, consume as a consumer, as a fan, I guess you would say. I got to do a deal a long, long time ago for a Robot Chicken Simpsons couch gag scene, which was a particular favorite of mine. So that was a cool thing that I got to work on. But yeah, that's, you know, it really has been a journey from, I forgot to mention this, I grew up in Iowa, I grew up in a small town in the middle of nowhere, but like Luke Skywalker, I wanted to get off the farm, so to speak, and come to Hollywood and you know, have my own adventure galaxy far, far away.
Awesome.
Seth Rollins to the stars, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. No, I can definitely relate to the moving away from where I began, and I hail from Michigan, so it's I live in Colorado now, but yeah, totally different landscape and opportunities.
Yeah, and you know, it's I've been very blessed in my career to have some really good opportunities working for major studios. I'm working on some pretty high profile projects, and now, you know, I run my own entertainment law firm where I get to kind of pick and choose the projects that I get to work on. So as of late, I have been working more in the animation space, working with animation, adult animation clients, trying to work with new content creators on things like publishing their own comic books or online comic books. I'm working with people who have, you know, toy licensing deals with Funko Pops or NECA toys or Hot Topic or whatever have you. So, I mean, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of fun at the same time. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Very cool, man. That's, yeah. And I know Mike's going to circle back around to the Funko Pops at some point.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, you don't play coy with me.
I have no idea. Absolutely.
Mike, are you a Funko Pop collector? I have a few. I'm not a big Funko Pop collector as much as I am a Marvel Legends collector. If there were an earthquake in California right now, I would be completely killed by falling Marvel Legend figures on my head.
Yeah, you'd be screwed. Yeah.
In particular, my 32-inch Galactus that's standing right above me.
No. Oh, wow.
No. You don't have that standing right above you. No, you never put the action figures above you. You're supposed to be above.
He looks pretty sturdy.
Okay, tell me that when a 4.8 hits.
There you go.
So you mentioned working on animation shows. So what is your particular genre or type of project that you're most drawn to in that space?
You know, I like working in adult animation because, again, that's what I consume as a consumer, as a fan, whatever you want to call it. The thing about adult animation is that it's not as much as a money driver as kids animation. Surprise, right? Of course, right? You know, adult animation is fun, and it, you know, there are some great shows, and obviously they're the exceptions to the rule, The Simpsons and King of the Hill and things like that. But generally speaking, you know, it's more so kids animation that drives merchandise and action figures. Yep. and licensing products. So while I, you know, enjoy working in adult animation, I suppose I wouldn't turn away clients that work in the Coco Melon or Shark, what's it called, Baby Shark Boo Boo Space or whatever it's called. Pink Fong's the company.
Oh, yeah.
I've actually done a few deals with them, but yeah, and I don't want to make it seem like I'm all work too. You know, I.
Oh yeah. We're getting some fun stuff too.
Yeah. No, of course. So yeah, that's working in animation. It's very unique relative to other areas of. Let's say compared to live action, you know, in live action, you are showing an actor as they are and you're depicting them in that role and you're photographing their likeness. For an animated series, you're just using their voice, and there are different concerns. There are different things that the studio needs in terms of using someone's voice in a voiceover role versus having an actor on set, which is, you know, obviously different too than having, you know, the director on set or you know, the rest of the cast and stuff. So it's all sorts of different types of deal making that goes into making all of those products.
Very cool.
We hear you have an impressive collection of action figures in Marvel Legends. How did you get started, and do you have any favorites?
Yeah, so I was a Marvel Legends collector back when they initially had the license with Toy Biz. I think I would have started collecting in 2004, 2005. Gave it up for the longest time when I was in law school, but then repicked back up the hobby in 2015. And like I said, if it earthquakes here, I'm going to be completely hammered by Marvel Legends. Probably my favorite's my Galactus, because that's kind of the holy grail of the collection. But, you know, never go wrong with Victor Von Doom. He's also right there in front of me. I have them spaced out between... I got probably 40 Avengers on one side and 25 to 30 villains on the other side.
So the heroes outnumber the villains. So that means the villains have to have their comeuppance.
Yeah.
That almost sounds like my Beast Wars collection.
Oh, you're a Beast Wars guy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're huge, huge Beast Wars fans. Like, I've got a cabinet of Beast Wars figures, Dragon Ball Z, Power Rangers, Star Trek.
I started getting a recollection of the Beast Wars figures after the new Netflix series, which ironically was the production was done by one of my clients, Rooster Teeth, or formerly a client of mine, Rooster Teeth. They did the production for Netflix's Transformers, The Age of Cybertron, or War for Cybertron, or whatever it was called, which saw the return of the Beast Wars, which I thought was so cool. I actually have the Nemesis and the Ark. Sitting in my home office because, you know, I was a big Beast Wars fan. It was really funny because when they announced that they were going to do that third season of the Transformers show with the Beast Wars, you know, being the central cast, I quickly, you know, phoned my mom because I had my old Beast War action figure collection somewhere in storage. And those things were, you know, this was not in the height of the pandemic, but somewhere in the middle of the pandemic. And those things were selling for a pretty penny.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
She threw them all away.
What?
I'm sure most of them were broken anyway. So that was a heartbreaker. But I have Dinobot. I have Black Arachnid. I have Ravage, the
Beast Wars version. Yep.
Covert Agent Ravage.
Yes. Yeah. Covert Agent Ravage. Yep. I with his dual pistols. Oh, that's one of my favorites.
I got that too.
I wanted the because they had a Japanese version that they didn't release in the United States.
Yeah, it was like X9 Jaguar.
Yeah, but I never got it, so I'm so glad that I ended up getting this one. The one that I have to get now that I don't have is Silverbolt. I saw they re-released that one, so that one I want to get.
Yeah, I don't have that one yet. I do have all of the iterations of Beast Megatron and like varying degrees of Masterpiece and War for Cybertron characters.
I was going to ask, do you have the Transmetal Masterpiece Megatron?
Yes.
that would be a holy grail in my collection as well. I don't have that one, but that would be a nice looking figure.
Oh, it's definitely awesome. I have a shrine of Megatron in my cabinet. Just ask Mike.
I love it.
Go ahead.
Well, 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 what do you have to say for yourself? I simply have a penchant for intelligent conversation. Yes.
I was so disappointed they didn't get the OG voice cast together for that. I was such a missed opportunity.
Oh, I know.
Stupid non-union bullcrap.
I was so sad. I was like, no, they could have done, the, you know, they could have brought our you know, our guys back.
Yeah. You know, they could have done it for the movie, too, but.
That's true.
I don't even think I remember that film.
I don't either, but I was like campaigning on Twitter. I was like, hey, I can do Beast Megatron if
yeah, why didn't they just get a sound alike? Oh
yeah.
Man.
Yeah. I don't know. But yeah, I was still glad because it at least brought the Beast back to the forefront.
Yeah. No, that was so cool. And I actually think someone did dub over it on YouTube if you want to listen to the original voice. I don't know if it's exactly a one for one of the show or whatever, but there are clips of the new show with the original voices.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah, Steve did a whole thing on that. Once he heard it, he was like, literally, I'm gonna puke is what he told me.
Well, I was more offended over Megatron than any of the others. But
I know, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
I actually re-recorded the dialogue with me doing the voice, and then I had a voice comparison, and people were, like, losing it on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Did Waspinator speak in that show? Because that would have been another one that I would have.
He didn't.
No.
Waspinator does not understand.
There you go.
Waspinator commenters. Scott McNeil's great.
Great impressions.
Thank
you. Yes, he does. Yes, he does.
I watched too many cartoons as a kid.
as a kid, I
still do. So
yeah.
So you're known for encyclopedic knowledge of movies and TV. Any theories you'd like to share with us on things kind of in the entertainment industry? Like I keep throwing hot takes or crazy theories of like what they're going to do with Marvel, but
oh gosh, that place is such a mess.
But I won't go there because I don't want to accidentally cause something.
Okay, before you answer, Joshua, I just have to get this off my chest. I think it was 2022. I think it was 2 years ago, 2022. There was a it was right after the pandemic kind of didn't die down, but it's everything opened back up.
Mm-hmm.
There was a convention. I think it was an SDCC where they're like, here. Here's everything, phases 5 and 6. This is what's coming. I'm like, you morons, don't do that because you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, they overplayed their hand there.
Very much so.
But that's kind of been a giant trend of studios as of the last 5 years. Like, I don't know what. I mean, I guess I do. There was 10 films that made over $1 billion in 2019, and I think that gave some uber confidence to especially Disney, who had like 6 of them. But it's really just been one giant CGI mess of, you know, a $300 million film after another, aside from Dune, which was great. But studios have not been nailing the landing, so to speak, in terms of finding what the audience wants. And it was funny, I was at a entertainment law convention over this past weekend, and they were comparing the 2019 film market, you know, with Avengers Endgame coming out that year, Lion King or Aladdin came out that year, maybe both of them did. I'm trying to think of what all the top 10 movies were. Anyway, 2019 was a pretty banger year for movies, and if you look at 2023, similar movies came out. They had the Marvels, they had the Little Mermaid remake, but all of those movies did relatively poorly. And, you know, the writing on the wall, at least in terms of what Hollywood thinks, is that, you know, people are over franchise films and people are over sequels, prequels and reboots. And I think to a certain degree, a lot of that is true. especially for the more, how do you say, advanced moviegoer, for people who really want to go to the movies and see the theaters. I think, you know, people are dying for something new or original. But for the general movie-going audience, that franchise, that blockbuster, the sequels, prequels, remakes, and reboots, that's always going to be a big driver towards, you know, a more uniform pull of all people towards the box office. And it's not necessarily that people are over those movies as much as the 2023 offerings just sucked. the Marvel sucked. Killers of the Flower Moon sucked. Trying to think. It's just not been a great time for movies in the last 5 years. And, you know, I'm really hoping that because of industry trends, because of the pressure that's been put on these studios in terms of tightening their budget and wringing in fiscal responsibility, we might see some more creative movies come out in the next 5 years. But yeah, my prediction is that we will see more smaller budgeted indie films. You're going to see a lot more horror films, because that really is the only thing that's proven in the last 5 years to make a buck, which, you know, I'm not complaining about at all. I love horror movies too. But you'll see probably less and less of the large 300 million Indiana Jones 5 films, thankfully, you know, for better or worse. But hopefully they'll find their footing in terms of releasing some good Marvel or Star Wars content again, although I remain skeptical.
So I have it pulled up here. Disney has had and still has 7 out of 10 from 2019. Only Sony and Warner Brothers have the other three. Sony has Spider-Man Far From Home and Jumanji Next Level, and Warner Brothers had Joker. In 2023 for the top 10?
Oh, in 2019, those were the top 10.
Yeah, that was the top 10 of 2019. In 2023, you've got one Disney movie. Two. You got Little Mermaid and Guardians Volume 3.
Little Mermaid made $1 billion? No way.
Top 10. Just highest
grossing. Top 10.
Yeah, highest grossing. It made $569 million. But compare 2019 to 2023, I see more different. Like, Disney isn't dominating 2023, whereas in 2019 they were. I see a Warner Brothers, Universal, two Universal movies, one Sony, and two Warner Brothers. So luckily, and that's the biggest thing, I want to eventually do a podcast episode for somewhere on our network about basically how we used to have all of these different, I know technically Touchstone is Disney, but like Touchstone Pictures and Regency, we used to have all these set, you know, Columbia, Paramount, all that stuff. They all used to be separate. Now it's like
the mini majors.
Yeah. Yeah, and now Disney, Warner Brothers, and basically own everything. I thought there was a third one in there, but there isn't.
Well, there's Disney, Warner Brothers, Paramount. That's the third one. Sony is still around. Sony actually is in an interesting position where they're the only movie studio that doesn't have a streaming output channel. Paramount, Disney, Warner Brothers, obviously they all have their own streaming platforms. Sony is unique in that they don't, which means they can, you know, license their products to the highest bidder amongst Netflix and all the other channels, which that kind of competition breeds more creativity. It usually will drive up, you know, the prices of things. Only problem is that, again, Sony's content has just really sucked. Aside from Anyone But You in the last, you know, 5 or so years. So excited to see Craven.
Yeah,
It'll definitely be interesting to see how they play that one out, especially considering, like, how bad Madame Web was received.
Yeah. Didn't sell the sarcasm good enough. I'm probably not going to see the Craven. Although I will go see Venom 3.
No, I won't. Nope. I've already hidden every single trailer and everything that Sony puts out with that movie on YouTube, I hide all of those videos. I have zero interest in that. What is the story about moving Kevin Feige's movie posters? Can you share any behind-the-scenes details about that experience?
Yeah, no, this is kind of a fun story I like to tell. So like I said, I interned at Marvel Studios when I was in law school. It was actually at a really unique time because they had not just been bought out by Disney, but the transitioning was finalized and they were moving from their Rosecrans Manhattan Beach office up to the Burbank lot for Walt Disney Studios. And, you know, at the Frank G. Wells building where all of the C-suite executives work, they put us up the Marvel Studios headquarters. But unfortunately, Kevin Feige's posters showed up. Not posters, but like the signed, autographed, framed Avengers 1 through whatever. I can't remember which one we were on at the time. Signed by all of the cast. Those priceless memorabilia showed up in the back of a moving truck, and there was no one to essentially bring them up the freight elevator up to Kevin's office, except for Kevin's assistant, who was a friend at the time, but she couldn't physically lift the posters. They were right. massively framed, you know, movie posters. So, you know, I, being the lowly intern, the bottom guy in the totem pole, volunteered to, you know, haul each one up individually up to Kevin's office and make sure that they got up there unbroken. Like every time I was going up a set of stairs with one of them, I saw my life flash before my eyes, because if I break one of these things, it's you know, priceless memorabilia from the Avengers movies. Just, you know, it kind of reinforces I like to tell that story because I feel like it reinforces a little bit about myself in terms of, like, you know, you really do have to be able to roll up your sleeves and tackle any job. You know, I was in a suit and tie and was going up to, you know, work a law desk, but, you know, just being who I am, you know, I saw a job, I saw it needed to get done. I took my suit jacket and tie off and rolled up my sleeves and did it. I think that's, you know, a good lesson for everyone in 2024.
Oh, for sure.
It's like Kevin Conroy said as Old Man Bruce in Return of the Joker. Joker's vain. He likes to talk. Block it out and power on through. I've used block it out and power on through ever since that movie almost 25 years ago. Oh, wow. Next year's 25th anniversary of Return of the Joker. Holy crap.
Rest in peace, Kevin Conroy.
Yes, yep. Absolutely.
The legend.
Absolutely.
I will say, I, you know, in the whole DC versus Marvel debate, DC's animated films are just top tier above anything that Marvel's put out.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah. That's always been the thing between the two when you do DC versus, because DC has the animation, Marvel has the live action. Now, there are some, you know, really good DC movies. You know, some depend on your taste of what is good and what isn't good and whatever. But, like, next year, and we're actually going to be doing this next year, Steve knows and doesn't know this, we have already completed two episodes covering the 90s, the late 80s, early 90s Batman movies. We did Burton's Batman and Schumacher's Batman. Next year is the 20th anniversary of Batman Begins, so we're going to cover the Dark Knight trilogy.
Oh, my goodness.
And Instagram, wow. I don't know what account it is on Instagram, but I get sucked into doom scrolling Instagram reels, and this account keeps showing me all these behind the scenes of Batman Begins, of the Dark Knight, of the Dark Knight Rise. I'm like, oh god, we're doing this podcast next year. Go ahead, sorry.
I was gonna say, like for me, I really think that watching the behind the scenes, watching how films get made, watching all of the blood, sweat, effort, and tears that go into making movies is so, not so much more interesting, but it's such an added layer to the movie experience itself. So watching those behind the scenes, talking about those behind the scenes, you know, I just watched an hour long video of all of the Easter eggs, tidbits, and fun facts about Batman Returns. And, you know, an hour and 5 minute runtime that I could have watched the movie. But, you know, just having that kind of inside information is just so much fun. And it's part of the business that I really love and enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely. And while I will agree that streaming services are easy and they're convenient and everything else, sometimes things leave streaming services completely. They don't just jump from Hulu to Netflix. They don't just do whatever. They just leave. And this is why I've been saying, I've been buying, again, since 2021, I've been buying more and more physical media again, and I haven't had a physical media collection since 2011. But I have a growing list and growing shelves of Blu-rays and 4Ks, and if I can get it, I have a 4K TV and a 4K Blu-ray player. So if I can get it in the highest quality, I will be getting it in the highest quality whatsoever.
Oh yeah, man after my own heart. I had when I moved to California from Iowa, I had 400 DVDs in regular theatrical movies, and then I had probably like 40 to 50 TV box sets, all the Simpsons, Seinfeld, South Parks, that kind of stuff. But, you know, after moving that once or twice in LA, plus storage and rent size, I'm like, I got to get rid of these things. So I got rid of everything. I think it was in 2013, 2014. But now I am finding myself, like you said, buying a lot more physical media. I just bought phases 1 through 3 of the MCU on Blu-ray 4K. We obviously have Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, and Star Wars on Blu-ray 4K. You never know what's going to happen. I call it my doomsday or no internet sale face, but yeah.
And the only downside, and I agree with you because I'm the same way. If I lose internet, well, as long as I still have electricity, then I thought to myself, because my girlfriend pointed this out to me, she's like, but if the internet goes out, the internet and the computers are what controls the power. So the power's, I'm like, oh crap, don't ruin this for me. Oh God.
One physical media I had to go out and buy not too long ago was the I had to track down a DVD of Dogma, Kevin Smith's Dogma, because that one has not been re-released, remastered at all on Blu-ray, and you can't find it anywhere on streaming. I think that might change starting next year, but I think I had to pay $40 on eBay for a DVD.
An old DVD copy of Dogma, not even a... Yeah, that's crazy.
It's just nuts. That one's got to rank up there. One of my favorite. Kevin Smith created an interconnected universe before the MCU made it cool, so...
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You're developing your own animated and scripted projects. Can you give us a sneak peek into what you're working on?
Oh, goodness gracious. I didn't know that was in there.
Hey, they gave me the ammunition. I took it.
Don't share the questions with the guests so we can have on-the-spot answers.
Let me put it this way. I am constantly immersed in ideas for film and television projects, animated, live action, whatever. I have spent... you know, my entire adult life learning how to make these properties or in projects and helping other people create things and get their own projects off the ground. I have no doubt that in the not too distant future, I will be working on more intimately my own creative projects, and I can't share anything right now, but yeah, things will be coming in the pipeline.
And then when you're ready to divulge that information, we'd love to have you back and discuss it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no. Absolutely.
So with kind of pivoting to a little bit of the legal side and a little bit of the creative side, what is, with your experience in both law and creative development, how do you see the relationship between the legal and artistic sides of the entertainment industry?
So I'm a firm believer that the legal and business side of entertainment should be subservient to the art itself. Do not ask any of my colleagues or executive friends that, because I firmly believe that, or not firmly believe, I think that they firmly believe that the business and legal affairs sides really drives the industry. The art has got to come first. And I really think that the last 10 years, last 15 years has been a trial run in what happens when you, how do you say, for lack of putting it delicately, let tech bros run the industry and really focus on a profit first, or not even profit first, a equity shareholder first model, a stock valuation model, and whatever's going to make our investors happy. Like you said, there used to be a lot more privately owned, smaller mid-size studios and production companies and or subsidiaries of the larger studios that kind of worked or acted independently. A lot of that is gone now. A lot of things are just now housed under one banner. And with that, we've seen, you know, kind of a dry up of creativity.
Technical difficulties. Let's move on, shall we?
I was just going to say, when's the last time you saw a really good, you know, raunchy adult Christmas movie, you know, like Bad Santa or something like that? They just don't make those anymore.
Although we got lucky this year with a bunch of sequels to movies that came out decades ago. So,
you know, did you guys see Beetlejuice?
I've seen it, but I've also seen Beverly Hills Cop 4, and I loved that one.
I was going to say, you know, I forgot about Beverly Hills Cop 4. That was really good. I really liked Beetlejuice. They're not, how do I say, they're not movies that are going to draw a lot of people to the cinemas, to the theaters. But for us, you know, people who really enjoy cinema, I really enjoyed them for what they were. I don't know. Beetlejuice did pretty well at the box office, has been doing pretty well at the box office.
Well, and they had a lot of merchandising, too, like the Halloween season coming up and everything else. Yep. And they really dove into that and took advantage of it, started seeing more of the old, you know, cartoon coming back out and things like that.
Yeah, the whole original cartoons on Tubi to watch for free. I don't work for Tubi. I'm not plugging Tubi in any meaningful way, but
I will plug them as long as I need to, because that service is the greatest service in the world.
They're the silent sleeper.
That's right. They have almost everything. They have almost all the, pretty much all the U.S.-based Transformers cartoons. They have every single episode of Columbo, which I plan on doing a whole podcast on. They've got everything over there.
Well,
and it's free.
I sincerely hope they learn to beat Netflix at their own game. So we'll see. But them and Roku have been on my list of companies to watch out for a while now.
Agreed.
How can creators protect their artistic vision while navigating the business side of the entertainment industry?
Hire a lawyer. No.
Hire him, folks.
We've done that before. No.
You know, it's kind of a trick question, because at the end of the day, there really is no such thing as a truly unique original idea. I firmly believe that. Even myself, sometimes I will think I have the most ingenious idea for a plot or something, and realize that, you know, it's been done by this, that, or the next thing. True originality lies in the expression. And so, you know, you can take stories that have been told and cliches and fairy tales and mythology and in parts of stories and stuff. And if you learn to tell and craft a narrative in a new, unique, expressive way, that is truly what is the essence of art, or what you want to protect. And so, you know, I always tell people that unless you have a M. Night Shyamalanian, like, I see dead people style twist, I wouldn't be too concerned with sharing my ideas with other people, because it's going to boil down to the expression of that idea. And really, there's so many people who have ideas. Ideas are not protectable under the Copyright Act. It is the expression of that idea that is protectable. So in my business, a lot of people talk, a lot of people have ideas for things, but not very few people, but the ones that do, you know, those are the ones that matter. So, you know, protecting yourself is great. Make sure that you file for copyright protection. Make sure you're registering your work with the WGA if you're a writer. You know, obviously don't share your work with scrupulous individuals if it is confidential or private or you don't want it seen before it's ready. But you know, China is going to steal ideas from the United States all day, every day. You know, we can't stop that. There is no foolproof way to completely protect or shield your idea.
And it's funny you say that, because we often say around here when we have a good idea, as soon as we spit the good idea out on a podcast that ends up, people end up hearing it, the next thing out of either one of our mouths is, Disney, don't steal our idea, please.
Now, to be fair, there have been a bunch of instances where companies have done more scrupulous things like stealing people's ideas, but yeah. Again, it lies in the expression. I teach entertainment business law at Los Angeles Film School, and one of the cases I like to talk about is a more recent incident where Pixar was sued by a tattoo artist because there was this van in the movie Onward, and this tattoo artist, she sued Pixar because the van in that movie almost completely resembled, was almost identical to hers. And I show it to my students in my law class because, you know, one could look at this van and look at this tattoo artist, this lady bringing a lawsuit, and say, you know, like, she's crazy, you know, why would Disney steal her idea for this van? Like, and not to mention, you know, again, people can have independent ideas about the same thing at the exact same time. So I try to show students that on the one hand, like, there can be a degree of separation between ideation and idea theft. But the devil's in the details, and the devils are in the facts of the case. And the facts of this case were that Pixar had rented her van specifically times for Pixar related activities, and or had approached her to license the van to use it, or something to that effect. Like, essentially Pixar was well aware that this van existed, and it could be shown through evidence, right? Because in 2024 there's an email record, there's a digital footprint of everything. So Disney ended up having to settle that case, having to, you know, pay that tattoo artist an undisclosed lump sum of money, because they were clearly in the wrong. They clearly had stolen her idea, but there was a very clear paper trail of how that occurred. You know, it more often than not, I'll have people come into my office, or I'll have people call me and say, hey, you know, I had an idea for a movie about Napoleon, and now Ridley Scott stole my idea. Well, it's like, you know, anyone can have an idea to make a movie about Napoleon, right?
Yeah.
So it depends is the lawyer's favorite answer all of the time. It depends. The devil's in the details. The facts and circumstance are going to dictate. Generally speaking, Hollywood doesn't have a bug around people trying to steal your ideas. But then every once in a while, you know, something
it does
like
happen occasionally.
The van incident happens.
Yeah. Be careful, folks. The police are after the entertainment lawyer as we're talking to him.
Yeah, I'm sorry, guys. It's a hot night in Santa Monica, I guess.
Isn't it always?
Yeah.
So with the rise of, since we're talking about that, with the rise of AI, how do you see intellectual property law evolving in the coming years?
You know, I really have no clue where intellectual property law is going to go, where copyright law is going to go. To me, the idea that all AI-generated art is not copyrightably protectable, that's an absurd assertion, and that's kind of the stance that the Copyright Office is taking at this point in time. But if you think about it and you boil down what AI really is, it's not too dissimilar from Photoshop or you know, what we use to program mocap or CGI or, you know, any advancements in computer technology that we've made in the last 20, 30 years. It's not the exact same as that, but there's an analogy to be made. And as long as a human hand is using the AI tool to create, I believe that people can use AI to make incredible works of art that should be protected by copyright law. But we'll have to see, you know, how the court kind of decides on that. Like I said, right now they kind of take the position that anything AI used to create won't qualify for copyright protection. But you know, it intellectual property, copyright law in general is kind of a fascinating topic. If you think about copyright law in comparison to patent law, you know, patent protection only lasts for 20 years. Copyright lasts for, you know, the life of the author plus, I forget what it is off the top of my head, 75 years or something.
And something then, like that.
95 for a corporation, from publication, or 120 from ideation. But you know, those copyright, you know, lengths of time, 100 plus odd years, that's a long time for protection. I don't know that level of protection is good for art or society. I don't know, to be honest with you.
I prefer actual intelligence to artificial intelligence. That's my stance on AI.
I will say, I think that artificial intelligence is highly overrated in the intelligence category. It is great at taking long, complex things and reorganizing them and, you know, taking, you know, a sentence and giving ideas for it. And it's good for what I like to call the ideation process, but it does not substitute in any way for a brain. You know, we use AI at our law firm for a lot of things, and I compare it to driving a race car. It's like a Formula One race car. You know, the average driver off the street can't get behind a Formula One race car and you know, do a million laps and do cool things with it. But the right driver behind the wheel with the right tools can, you know, open that car up and do some really cool stuff.
That's a great analogy. And I actually think of it very similar, just because I tend to think of it like old school search engine. Like when you had to use the Boolean searches and you had to kind of know exactly like what you were looking for to get it to come up and the right way to ask the question. And so, like, it's very much like that. You have to kind of know how to use the tool and what you're using it for, but it's not good for the end product. It's good for the getting, you know, the wheels turning in your brain to go the rest of the way.
Yeah, like, you know, I'm writing an episode of a TV show about Thanksgiving, you know, dinner, and I type into ChatGPT, what are the most common family conflicts that occur, you know, during Thanksgiving, and, you know, I can find, you know, ideas in that to use, but it's not like it's writing anything for me.
But I can clearly tell you, it's whoever gets the last baked potato, whoever gets the last piece of pumpkin pie, and depending on what football team you're a fan of, whoever gets to watch the game first.
That sounds like a very mild Thanksgiving there, Mike.
Like they burn the dinner and have to go out, and then all the places are closed, and then.
Do you guys watch The Bear?
No.
On Hulu FX?
No, I haven't yet.
It's a really good show about a chef who's trying to win a Michelin star for a restaurant in Chicago, but there's this a very now famous episode, I think it's called like the Five Fishes or something like that, set over Christmas with Jamie Lee Curtis and a huge ensemble cast, but it's one of the best episodes of television I've ever seen. It's really good.
We'll have to check that out.
Yeah, the only reason I bring it up is it's a pretty intense family fight scene at a holiday dinner, so.
What are some current trends in Hollywood that creators should be aware of before signing any deals?
Oh boy. nobody's paying anything? I don't know. I don't know how to answer that question. You know, the motto on the street right now is survive to 2025. I think a lot of the companies, a lot of the studios, a lot of the financiers are licking their wounds. They're looking at the high interest rate as, you know, kind of being problematic and a barrier for jumping into investing again. I'm hoping 2025 will be a more robust year for indie filmmaking and or, mm-hmm. you know, private equity, private investments into the entertainment industry in general. As far as trends go, you know, it old is the new again. Look for things in the early 2000s that were really popular. Rediscovering things from the early 2000s right now, music, pop culture, brands. I imagine that's going to be pretty in vogue for the next 5 years. As you know, people 10 years my junior starting to become the main purchasers, start to get more of that purchasing power, that purchasing dollar power. You'll see a rise of those trends, not too dissimilar from the 90s trends we've seen, you know, recently as well.
So it'll be kind of like all the callbacks that were in Deadpool and Wolverine.
Yeah, I mean, oh goodness, we could talk about that. yeah, no, Deadpool versus the Wolverine. That was a great movie. It was like watching all of the internet memes of the 2000s combined together into one film. It was, yeah, you know, there'll be more of that.
Well, after all, I mean, nostalgia is what rules the universe now, because there is no new idea. There is only a way to modify current ideas. There is no new breakout, and it's our own fault, because we were raised in the 70s, 80s, and 90s to the point of, we started with all this stuff, and now all the companies are like, we need to make money. Let's make more of the stuff they loved 40 years ago.
Yeah. No, and you'll have that, of course. I lost my train of thought. I was going to say something cool and interesting, but I forgot it.
Sorry.
No, nostalgia bait goes a long way, but I do think that people are in the mood and or craving for something original. Now I remember what I was going to say. You know, it has always been true that all art is recycled. Even going back to Picasso and to Plato, everyone has always said that good artists borrow, great artists steal. So it's not necessarily the regurgitation of things that is the issue. It is the fact that the regurgitation of these things has not created or supported anything new. You know, you can always look at art and see the influences in the history and where, you know, they have borrowed inspiration from. Hollywood just needs to find that again.
No, I agree. That's a lot of the old can work still. It's just the implementation. And that's one of the things I've loved with some of the more recent Ryan Reynolds films that have been released on Netflix, is it's got a mixture of different things in a new packaging, and it feels fresh.
I think that's the best we're going to get in 2024, to be real honest. I mean, I really liked Alien Romulus. It was Alien 1 in 2024. I was pleased with it.
So What are some of the essential things that you think creators need to know to kind of protect themselves online, especially like us being podcasters? Like, what are some of the things that you would kind of recommend to watch out for to stay on the good side of the law and not have people come after you?
Yeah,
because you got a Google image off of Google. Anyway, that's a long story.
Yeah, I mean, you always want to be careful when you're using third-party intellectual property, whether that's images, whether that's video clips, whether that's sound bites. You know, podcasts and online digital media is a lot more forgiving than film or television is as it relates to, you know, unlicensed sampling, if you want to call it that. But you always want to be aware of who you're ripping from. You want to be aware of people who are highly litigious. You know, the Tolkien estate is highly litigious. Sir Arthur Cohen's estate is highly litigious. If you get a takedown notice from somebody, take it seriously and take the content down, you know, and I guess, you know, in terms of best practices, you know, make sure that you are, you know, filing for a corporation, you have your ownership structures with your partners figured out, you have, you know, your equity splits figured out, when you're engaging with people, you know, you're having them sign appearance releases or voiceover releases or something like that. If you're, you know, filming in a location, you're getting, you know, a waiver of liability in case somebody gets hurt. Really, you know, just a number of things that you can do to overly protect yourself if you have the budget and the means to you know, get that kind of one-on-one consulting with an attorney.
Makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So, what are some of your favorite TV shows and characters?
Oh, gosh. You know, right now, I am hardly watching anything on TV that is new. I take that back. I'm really enjoying Agatha all along right now. I think that that's fits in well with October. My wife and I usually do a 31 days of Halloween every October, so we've been binge watching Halloween movies. In terms of like OG legacy shows, I'll go back and watch Simpsons a million times over. Same thing with Dragon Ball Z or Arrested Development or Smallville. But, you know, I think at this point in my career, I have, how do I say, not as much time to go back and rewatch things. I actually, that's how I measure a good movie or film is, would I go back and rewatch it knowing that I have a limited amount of time right now? And if the answer is yeah, then it was a pretty good movie.
That's a pretty good answer. Cause like I fluctuate between TV shows as well and films, and I kind of weigh it based on, you know, I have this handful of things that I'll actually still watch after I've seen it the first time. And part of it is I remember all the movies and TV shows after I watch them. And it takes years to filter out.
Yes. He remembers all of them. And then he remembers all the ones that he got canceled.
Jerk. Yeah. Shh. when I used to go to my in-laws, they would have the TV on 24/7, and I'd walk in the room and within 5 seconds I would have the movie picked out that they're watching, and they were like, how did you know? And I'm like, I heard 5 seconds of this or whatever. Jogged my memory, and then like, I just keep going, you know. But yeah. So last question here, what are the top three questions any creator should ask a potential entertainment lawyer?
Goodness gracious. Number one, how much do you charge? How much do you cost? Number two, are you the right entertainment lawyer for the job? There are a lot of different types of entertainment lawyers to do a lot of different things, right? Like I said, you know, there are entertainment litigators who show up to court and they argue issues in front of a judge, and they take people to court and they sue and they issue lawsuits and demand letters. I am not that type of lawyer. I am the, hey, if you have a deal in hand, if you're being offered a gig, whether that's an engagement or a merchandising deal or a brand deal or something to that nature, if you're looking to make money off of your entertainment project and you have a buyer lined up, that's where I come into play. So yeah, number two, know what type of entertainment lawyer you need. And number three, you know, like you want any relationship with a lawyer to be a good fit. You want to be able to actually speak with that lawyer as a human and make sure that they understand what your needs and interests are and that you can communicate that to them effectively. Because really, you know, we're hired servants. We're hired on behalf of the creators to carry out and advocate their wants and desires and what they want to see in terms of a deal. So don't be afraid to ask. Don't be afraid to give direction. Work with your lawyers, correspond with your lawyers, figure out what is truly the best deal for you, because we are kind of the race car, if you will, but you guys are the drivers.
Yeah, that's great. That's great information to remember for really anybody that's in creating content.
Yes, most definitely. All right. That's going to do it, I think. Would you like to give out your social media? You don't have to if you don't want to.
Yeah, no, I'm really easy to find. You know, you can find me at my website, lastingentertainmentlaw.com. You can find me on Instagram at lastinglaw. I think it's the same handle for TikTok, although I don't check my TikTok very often. I don't even know what TikTok is. Me either. Yeah. No, find me on Instagram. Looking forward to, you know, hopefully creating the next wave of animated series and live action nerdy stuff for all of us to enjoy and consume.
Absolutely. Awesome. Absolutely. Yep, yep. All right, folks, that's going to do it for this one. This is Geekcast Radio, episode 345. 15 years and only 345 episodes of this show. We've got other ones that have a higher count, but that's because I'm insane. So, any other geeky-type things you want to say, Joshua, before we get to the closing?
No, just stay nerdy, keep pumping out ideas, and follow, you know, your heart in terms of those ideas, and if you have something really cool, just try to get it made. It's never been an easier time to get stuff made now with AI and all the apps and everything, so find your passion and follow it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us on this episode of Geekcast Radio Presents, and thank you to our guest, Joshua Lastain. Be sure to check out his website at the link in the episode's post. Steve, thank you as always. Next time, folks, I have no idea. I really don't. Geekcast Radio, the flagship podcast, has always been... Oh, actually, I do know what the heck we're doing next time. I do know. I can't believe I know this, but I know. Steve will be back. We are going to be doing a, which I can't believe this happened all in the same year. I was shocked. Literally, I almost fell out of my chair. But we will be doing the breakout roles of Jim Carrey, Ace Ventura, Wears a Mask, and Gets Dumb and Dumber. Because all three movies came out 30 years ago in 1994. February, July, and December. February was Ace, July was Mask, and December was Dumb and Dumber. I was shocked, because I could have sworn those movies came out at least a year apart from each other.
Ooh. Technical difficulties. Let's move on, shall we?
All right, folks. Well, everybody left. Everything is fine. It was just a time crunch, that's all. But... thank you for listening to this episode of Geekcast Radio Interviews. Coming up soon, we will have more interviews on Geekcast Radio as well as more topics on the flagship show. I have been TF21 Mike, Steve Megatron, and transactional entertainment lawyer Joshua Lastine were on this episode with me. Steve is always with me, obviously. He's co-creator of the network. Thank you so much to Joshua for all his information. Such a great interview, folks. Amazing, amazing information. Something everybody in the entertainment industry, no matter what part of it you're listening to, or what part of it you're listening to, wow, I can't talk. No matter what part of it you're in, you should listen to this interview. Unleash the Geek in You, and we will catch you next time.
Just heard a podcast from the Geekcast Radio Network. If you enjoyed this discussion, head over to geekcastradio.com to check out this episode's post for more insights and links. Interact with the show, feedback at geekcastradio.com, or interact with us on X at Geekcast Radio and on Facebook at Geekcast Radio Network. Don't forget to subscribe to the Geekcast Radio Network of podcasts on your favorite podcatcher. So until next time, unleash the Geek.